Martha Acklesberg teaches government and women's studies at Smith College, teaches courses on urban politics, feminist theory, social movements. We're talking about her book, Free Woman of Spain, Anarchism and the Struggle for the Emancipation of Women. Martha, you were talking about kind of how anarchist theory and practice differed when it came to women and acknowledging what they were going through and addressing their concerns. And so when these women in Spain decided to form a separate and autonomous women's group called Mujeres Libres, I guess the question becomes, well, why an autonomous organization? Why go outside of the existing anarchist organizations to which, as you write, they did belong and were very active? Why did they feel a need to move beyond that and perhaps not instead try and reform or even revolutionize those organizations from within?
Yeah, that's a good question, which anybody involved in such activities has to be asking all the time. I think mostly, the short answer to that question is that they were trying to do both. They never left the anarchist movement organizations. They just did this in addition. Now, why would they have done that? I think for a number of reasons that are very directly connected to their understanding of what anarchism was and was about, as they put it themselves. They needed to be able to come to a sense of their own capacities, their own abilities, and they couldn't do that in what were male-dominated organizations where they were never given the opportunity, really, to develop their own capacities. So they struggled with the men in these organizations, as I talk about in the book. They, you know, many of them talk about experiences they had in rationalist schools and unions and meetings and various places, and they continued to do that, but they were always working against people who were in a position of power vis-a-vis them. The men had much more experience. The men were much more used to hearing their own voices in public. The men were, even though they were themselves subordinated within the larger society, they were used to being the bosses of their home and their women. And the women felt that unless they could be in their own spaces, I guess, they wouldn't be able to recognize the capacities in themselves that they would need to develop. So, as I said, they continued to work within the larger, within the male-dominated but supposedly gender-inclusive anarchist movement organizations, but they also founded this group precisely based on their understanding of these principles of direct action, that if you're going to, you've got to start working to create the society by being in situations where you can develop in yourself the capacities you want to develop.
Did they see themselves as feminists?
No, because feminist had for them a very particular meaning, which was interesting. It took me a while to understand this when I was interviewing them, in fact. They identified feminism with bourgeois feminism, with gaining the right to vote, and with women gaining access to, let's say, traditionally male professional occupations. Now, these were anarchists who, as I said before, had no use for government, so they had very little interest in gaining the vote. And as working-class women, they were not interested in women's gaining access to formerly male professional occupations. They were interested in creating a whole new structure that did not replicate, that did not maintain class in place. And they saw feminism as basically a middle class movement that was anti-male and was trying to get women access into middle class or upper class male profession. So in that respect, they did not define themselves as feminists.
When the attempted military coup by four Spanish generals, including Francisco Franco, was launched in July of 1936, which sort of set in motion the Spanish Civil War, I mentioned at the top of the hour there was all this ferment. There were all these revolutionary transformations. People took over factories and operated them themselves. Land was expropriated from absentee landlords. There were collectives formed. Municipalities set up new systems. People interested in what happened can certainly pick up this book, Free Women of Spain, which goes into that in some detail. Did the women, the women who were participating and active in all these anarchist organizations, did they see this as an outlet, as a way of kind of creating their own reality, of enacting women's equality both in rural and urban areas?
The social revolution you're referring to?
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, they had these groups of women had been forming starting really in the late 1934, 1935. Women had been meeting together almost like what we saw in this country in the 60s in sort of consciousness-raising groups to talk about their experiences in movement organizations and to begin developing a kind of understanding and an analysis for themselves of what was going on and what they needed to do to try to address it. And then they started hearing about one another. You had a larger meeting of some of these women in Barcelona early in 1936 when they began to formulate, I guess, the idea for some ongoing way for women to work together to try to address these things. But then the outbreak of the Civil War and the Social Revolution provided, let's say, many more contexts and a kind of immediacy of need for the sorts of things that Mujeres Libres was committed to. I mean, part of the reason that you had Social Revolution here was the Civil War began, the generals, it was basically an attempted coup d'etat. The coup d'etat was defeated in a number of areas of Spain, especially around Madrid, Valencia, and Catalonia. And it was defeated by a popular uprising. So in many of these places, the landowners or the factory owners or the people who were in charge fled. They were afraid of what was going to happen when these revolutionaries were in charge, which left the factories and the land without any management. So in some cases, union organizations sort of threw out the managers who were there, but in many of them, the managers simply fled, and the unions had to pick up the pieces. So that was a very big impulse for the social revolution. But the reason that it was able to happen was, of course, because you had had this 60, 70 years of organizing in Spain beforehand. Now, once the revolution began, Mujeres Libres, which I think, had there been no social revolution, who knows what these women might have ended up doing,
mm-hmm.
but they found themselves in a situation of women being needed, at the very least, to step up and move into the factories, to take different kinds of roles in agriculture when the men were off at the militia. So they started apprenticeship programs in addition to the kind of literacy and popular education programs that they probably would have held anyway. But I think certainly the apprenticeship aspects of what they were doing and the helping women to move into employment in a very different way than they had before, that was clearly very much a product of the social revolutionary atmosphere.
How did they go about, how did Mujeres Libres analyze women's subordination? How did they explain subordination, say, at home?
Well, I think they saw subordination at home as a reflection, a further ramification of relations of domination and subordination that people experienced out in the world. Many of the women that I interviewed who were from anarchist families and who were involved in relationships with anarchist men, their compañeros, nevertheless said that the average anarchist male who, as one of them put it, however revolutionary he was out in the factory or out on the streets, when he came home, wanted to have somebody to make his dinner and clean his clothes and take care of his kids and not necessarily to be a comrade in arms with him. I mean, I don't necessarily mean literally in arms, but mm-hmm. necessarily a comrade in struggle with him. That the anarchist men had in fact absorbed attitudes toward women from the larger society. So that's why that needed to be addressed within the context of the anarchist movement organizations and journals and newspapers, but that the women would need the support from other women, which they could really get only in this separate organization. That's another reason why you needed a separate organization, because couldn't do that kind of support work in a mixed sex group.
Mm-hmm. I wonder about the attraction of women to the anarcho-syndicalist strain of Spanish anarchism. You mentioned earlier that anarcho-syndicalists envision society with unions, trade unions at their base, coordinated by kinds of federations mm-hmm. to which delegates would be sent from each, I guess, factory mm-hmm. or workplace. And that kind of brings to mind for me this Marxist notion that, you know, the economic relations, that the workplace, that the relationship between the capitalist class and the working class sort of drives oppression and domination in society. And so I wonder, with the anarcho-syndicalists, with their stress on the workplace and on the employer-worker relationship, whether feminists, or maybe not feminists, but women back then, saw that as maybe unnecessarily leaving out or reducing the importance of women's concerns, women's subordination.
I think to some extent it did, and they saw it that way. But the other thing was, it's also important to point out, which I didn't mention before when we were talking about the structure of work, that many, many of the textile workers in Catalonia, for example, were women. You had, even though the ideology was women should be at home, many young women, girls in their teens, and up and at least until they got married, and some even while they were married, were in fact working in textile factories. The majority of textile workers in Catalonia in the early 30s were women, even though they were a tiny fraction of people in the leadership of unions. So I think, well, on the one hand, you're right that many of these women were pushing for a vision of social organization, social reality that extended way beyond the workplace. They also saw that workplace-based organization was and should be important for women's emancipation, that it would be, you couldn't have it without attending to the workplace. Maybe attending to the workplace alone wouldn't be sufficient, but you certainly couldn't do it without that piece. So I think it was a kind of both and rather than either or.
Mm-hmm. We have been talking a lot about workplaces, and yet you write that anarchist organizing and activity at this time in the 1930s, in the midst of the Spanish Civil War, really did go beyond the workplace, really did reach out to non-unionized workers, to non-workers, to home workers, to the unemployed, to people with disabilities, to domestic workers, to non-working parents. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was one of the most exciting aspects of what they were doing, and particularly what the work that Mujeres Libres was doing, was really trying to think about women's lives and all the ways in which they could be improved, they could be made different. Women could learn from one another and develop the capacities to change them. So they had programs, as I mentioned, literacy, education on all kinds of levels, because they drawing on these longstanding anarchist beliefs, absolutely were deeply committed to the idea that if you can't understand what's going on, and if you can't read, you can't really get the information you need to understand what's going on in society. And that is one of the most disempowering aspects of ways in which disempowerment works. But they also had, they offered programs in child rearing, in motherhood. They provided access for women to information about their bodies and birth control, sexuality. This was a, Spain at that point was an extremely repressive traditionalist society. Many women knew nothing about their bodies. They had very, they had been brought up themselves with very rigid understandings of proper child rearing. They might have known they didn't want to do that, but they might not necessarily have known how to do it otherwise. And Mujeres Libres wrote books and pamphlets and organized speakers. They also helped women develop their own public speaking abilities. Many of the women that I interviewed said that when they, you know, initially they were kind of meek and they were afraid to be heard in public, but they were really encouraged by other women to speak out and speak up. They had programs that were directed to prostitutes. But they had a plan anyway for what they called Liberatorios de Prostitución, which would be places, institutions where prostitutes could go and be retrained for other lives and other work. So they were really trying to address the situation of women, working class women, in all the different dimensions of their lives. This and is, given that they were doing this in the middle of the Civil War, I think they were remarkably successful.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Co-producer Sasha Lilly is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song. Martha Acklesberg, author of Free Woman of Spain, joins us today. We don't have much time left, and one thing we didn't really talk about was where anarchist groupings fit into the broader context of radical groupings that made up the popular front of the Spanish Republic, like socialists, like communists. Let's spend some time on that and kind of draw out the political context of what the anarchists were trying to do.
Okay, at the time, let's say in February of 1936, when the popular the election, there was a election nationwide in Spain, and a Popular Front coalition was elected. You had at that point, there are estimates of somewhere between 850,000 and a million members of the Anarcho-Syndicalist Labor Confederation, and roughly the same number of people involved in socialist unions and parties. So the anarchists and the socialists were the two main certainly working-class organizations in Spain. The communists at this point had estimates about 3,000 members. They were a very, very teeny group. And then you had all kinds of political groups in the middle, from regionalist, autonomous groups to left Republicans, centrist Republicans. I mean, you had, it was a very complex, confusing, and politicized and contentious time in Spain. And between February and July, you had lots of upheaval, partly because workers on the left, both rural, workers in both rural and urban areas, were looking to this Popular Front government for pretty dramatic reforms. And landowners and factory owners and others on the right were very nervous about the possibility of such reform. So there was a lot of contention, and that's what kind of led ultimately to the general's rebellion in July, that the right decided they didn't want to take their chances anymore. They just wanted to try and throw out this Republican government and put in, go back to a much more traditionalist, authoritarian way of organizing society. So the anarchists and the socialists, the anarchists obviously were in this kind of funny position. They were clearly, once the Civil War broke out, opposed to the fascists and found themselves in this sort of funny position of fighting to support the Republic, even though they weren't exactly, you know, they weren't advocating a return to Republican government exactly, but they certainly were wanting to oppose the fascists. And so you had these kind of strange coalitions.
Yeah, and people who want to learn a lot more about what was happening with the various radical and reformist political tendencies and social tendencies in Spain will want to pick up Martha Ackelsberg's book, Free Women of Spain, Anarchism and the Struggle for the Emancipation of Women. We have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. We really only have a minute left. I wonder if you could reflect on maybe one lesson that we might learn from the experience of this women's organization, Mujeres Libres.
Well, I would say particularly in our current political moment, it's important to remember that here were people who were poor, downtrodden, working-class women in the midst of a very brutal civil war, as you referred to, and they, along with others, worked together to try to create the world in which they wanted to live. The way one brings about a revolution, they insisted, was to really do that. Radicalism is born of action and activism. And I think that lesson and the one that individual and collective empowerment go together, that we don't rise individually to make a revolution or to make the society that we want, but we have to work together. And together we can all be strengthened, both individually and collectively.
We have to leave it right there. Martha Ackelsberg, author of Free Woman of Spain, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And Sasha and I will look for you next time.